Good to see you today. Thank you for worshiping with us today. We're going to be in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 22 today. So go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 11. Now, before we get into it, I want to start by talking about an album that I've been listening to as I've been writing these sermons on Hebrews chapter 11. It's called Fingers Crossed, and it's by a musician named Derek Webb. By show of hands, any of you guys know who Derek Webb is? Okay, I've got one person, my mother-in-law, a couple other people. All right. How about the band Cademan's Call? Any of you guys know, have you heard of Cademan's Call? Okay, a little bit more of you. Derek Webb used to be one of the main songwriters for the Christian band Cademan's Call. He left the band just a little bit over 10 years ago, I think, to pursue his own solo career. And he's just a very, very good writer. Provocative guy, but I like that. I like that about him. Now, the music of Cademan's Call was very formative to me in my walk with Christ. The heyday of Cademan's Call was probably like the late 90s, early 2000s. It's when they were really big. And that was, you know, right about when I was in college, when I was in seminary, things like that. So these were like prime years for me of figuring out what it means to be an adult and, you know, what I believed about God apart from all the things that I had heard in Sunday school growing up. Now, back in the day, Derek Webb wrote songs about, you know, things like hardships that he went through that made him question some of these easy answers that he heard growing up. He wrote about being single and lonely and how frightening it is to have to trust God with that. He had songs about, you know, leaving home and leaving his family and missing his family and not knowing where God was going to take him in life and just how hard it was to trust God and all of that. He had songs about failure and depression and God's faithfulness through all of that as well. And so as a young guy in Bible college and then in seminary, I really appreciated his art. Okay, it was what I listened to in my dorm room. It was what I listened to on my Discman. Remember those days before the iPods? Well, let's do it on my Discman at like coffee shops in the library when I was studying. In many ways, Derek Webb's music was the soundtrack to my theological education, my spiritual formation, and my early adulthood. Well, like I said, Derek Webb put out a new solo album a few weeks ago, and it's called Fingers Crossed. And he says, you know, he said in articles he's written about the album that it's about two divorces. First, it's about his divorce from his wife, which happened about a year and a half ago. But second, it's about his divorce from God. And so with the album, Derek Webb announced to the world that he was walking away from Jesus. Now, considering the impact that Derek Webb's music had on me, I just was very interested in, you know, what the album was about and why he was walking away. And so I've been listening to it a lot. And as I've been listening to it, I've been asking myself the question, what would Jesus have to say to Derek Webb? Now, I don't know what Jesus would have to say to Derek Webb. And honestly, the more I thought about it, the more I thought that he would probably just put his arm around Derek and tell him that he's loved. And it's the kind of thing that Jesus does. And further, I don't know the details of everything that's going on in Derek Webb's life, but based on the story that he tells in the album, Fingers Crossed, if he were to come up to me and he were to ask me for advice, and honestly, I don't think that's what he's looking for right now. I don't think advice is what he needs. But if he were to ask me for advice, or if he were to ask me for like some words of wisdom or something like that, this is what I would say to him. Life is hard, but we can't allow life as it is to kill our imagination of life as it could be. Life is hard, but we can't allow life as it is kill our imagination of life as it could be. We can't let cynicism win. Now, it's no surprise to you to hear that life is hard. You know, I bet for most of you, there have been times in your life where, you know, life has just punched you so hard in the stomach that it has made you question everything you believe about God. you know, we all have dreams about what life is gonna be like, right? What kind of person we're gonna be, what kinds of things we're gonna do, what our family's gonna look like, things like that. And when life shatters those dreams, it's easy to question God. It happens all the time. Now, in Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells one of his most famous stories. We call it the parable of the prodigal son. And in the story, Jesus says, there's this guy, and he had two sons. And one day, the younger one of his sons came up to him, and he's like, Dad, I want you to give me the share of the inheritance that's coming my way. And if you're familiar with the story, you probably know that this would have been very insulting to his dad. This would essentially have been like the son saying, Dad, you are as good as dead to me. The only value that I have of you is this money that's coming to me when you die. So could you just go ahead and give that to me now? I mean, what a heartbreaking thing to hear from one of your children. But in the story, you know, Jesus says that, you know, the dad went ahead, he divided the inheritance up, he gave the younger son his portion, and then the text says the younger son gathered all that he had, and he took a journey into a far land and squandered all of his property in reckless living. Now, a key phrase in all of that is not many days later. Not many days later. In other words, it didn't take the younger son very long to leave for the far country because he had been thinking about it for a long time. Right? He had been planning. He had been dreaming. His heart was already in the far country. And so as soon as he got the money, like, he was gone, right? He was gone. And that's true of a lot of things. When we long for the far country, it's not hard to move to the far country. Now, in today's text, the one that we're gonna look at, you know, today, we're in, like I said, we're gonna be in Hebrews 11, 8 through 22. And it is not about the prodigal son, it's about Abraham. But there's a lot of interesting parallels between the prodigal son and Abraham, because Abraham too moved to a faraway country. Now, his situation's a little bit different because in his situation, God told him to move to a faraway country, but the stories are similar. And I do wanna summarize it real quickly for those of you who maybe are not familiar with the Abraham story before we get into Hebrews 11. In Genesis chapter 12, God calls Abraham. And at the time, his name was Abram. Later, his name is changed to Abraham. But at the time, his name is Abram, and he's living in a land called Haran. And God says to him, Abram, I want you to get up and I want you to leave everything. I want you to leave your family. I want you to leave your home. I want you to leave your job. I want you to leave everything. And I want you to go to this place where I'm going to show you. And this is the beginning of God's relationship with Abraham. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the story, there's two things that you need to know about this story. First is that this was Abraham's first encounter with God. Right? So it's not like, you know, Abraham had this long-standing relationship with God and this was just like the next chapter in their journey together. To this point, Abram was probably involved in some kind of idolatry and this was a new thing. Like, he's hearing from God for the first time. It would have been new. It would have been strange. It would have been frightening. So that's the first thing you should know. The second is that God's call to Abram was to leave behind everything. Like, leave his family, leave his home, leave his, you know, his job and his wealth, leave behind everything and go to the place where God would show him. The stakes were high. And Abram had to trust this God whom he had never met before, never heard from before. And yet he did it. And so in Hebrews 11 that we're gonna look at today, it gives the preacher is gonna give us some lessons to learn from Abraham's life. And we're gonna start by reading just verse 8 of Hebrews chapter 11. It says, now by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. Now let's stop there. I want you to imagine for a second that you're Abraham, okay? You're 75 years old, you're married, but you don't have any children. And your family, like, you probably live with your dad and your cousins and your brothers and sisters, like your whole extended family, you live together, and they are all firmly committed to idol worship, and they are all very happy in Haran. And then one day, the true God speaks to you. and you've never heard of this God before. Like, it's not something that's familiar to you, but God speaks to you. And he's like, I want you to leave everything, leave your family, leave everything, and I want you to go to this place. And then God, he doesn't even tell you where you're going. He's like, just go, and I'll explain later. Right? And then yet in verse 8, it tells us that Abraham, by faith, obeyed. When he was called out to a place, by faith, Abraham obeyed. Now, what do we learn from this? Well, one thing we learn is that faith is not the opposite of obedience. Sometimes we get into this mindset that faith is the same thing as belief. So faith is like believing the right things. And while it's true that believing the right things is a part of faith, is an aspect of faith, the two are not synonymous. And what can happen is if we think of faith in terms of just believing the right things, then when we doubt, we can have this kind of existential crisis. Right? Because if faith is belief, then the opposite of faith is doubt. Now, I get asked about doubt all the time. This is something that a lot of people wrestle with. And they come up to me and they're like, Matt, do you ever wrestle with doubt? Because I doubt sometimes. And the answer is yes, sometimes I do. I do wrestle with doubt, but I'm okay with that. Because doubt is not the opposite of faith. In fact, you could argue that doubt is necessary for faith. And think about it. If something is obviously true and beyond any shadow of a doubt, then it really doesn't take any faith to believe it, right? In some ways, doubt is what makes faith faith. Now, part of our misunderstanding in all of this has to do with the way we read Hebrews 11:1 and the way that we carry it over into English and how we misunderstand it. In the ESV, Hebrews 11:1 says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for. Okay, well, what does that mean? Assurance of things hoped for. Well, when we have this idea that faith is about belief, not only then do we think of it as belief, but because it's assurance, we think that like strong faith is absolute confidence and, you know, this really strong assurance that we can't be wrong. But in the New Testament, faith isn't just mere belief. Faith is a way of life. And so I really like how New Testament scholar Gareth Cockrell in his commentary on Hebrews, I love how he talks about Hebrews 11:1 and what it means. I want to go through this. It's a little bit dry. That's probably the best word for it. So I'm going to try to track with me. It's not super long, but it's really helpful. He writes, many English versions translate the first part of this verse, faith is the assurance of things hoped for. And then Cockrell says, however, this subjective understanding of the word translated assurance has little support in contemporary usage. Okay, now what he means by that is when it says faith is the assurance of things hoped for, that word translated assurance is just a very difficult word to translate. It doesn't appear in the Bible or in Greek literature that often, and it's something that just scholars struggle with. Okay, how do we bring this over in English? And he says that he doesn't like the word assurance for it. He thinks reality is a better English word to describe what this Greek word means. And he says, this is Cockrell still, reality is more in line with the linguistic evidence. For instance, the philosophers use this term to distinguish reality from mere appearance. It was also used for the guarantee or the title deed to property in the business transactions of ordinary life. Right, so he's saying that he would translate it, faith is the reality of things hoped for. Literally, that's what it should say. So what do we do with that? Well, Cockrell says, we probably understand this statement best, however, if we remember that faith refers to a way of life and not a mere theoretical belief. So thus, we could paraphrase the verse, and I love this, and this is why I'm reading this. Faith is living in accord with the reality of things hoped for. Faith is living in accord with the reality of things hoped for. Or in other words, faith is living as if the things we hope for are real. Love that. Faith is living as if the things we hope for are real. And I like that. Faith isn't about being 100% convinced of your beliefs, like just with this reckless assurance and confidence. It's about acting on those beliefs, even if you don't have 100% confidence, even when you doubt. And that's exactly what Abraham does in verse 8, right? Now, it doesn't say that Abraham had doubts, but he certainly didn't have all the answers. He certainly was like, hey, I don't know who this God is, but I'm stepping out and I'm following him despite the fact that I don't have all the answers. He acted anyway. Now there's this walkway in China that goes along a sheer cliff in the Taihang mountain range. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. But it's 1180 meters above sea level, which is 3,871 feet. Okay, so can you picture this? There's this sheer cliff, like my hand here, and then along the cliff, there's this walkway that's 3,871 feet above the ground. Now here's the thing about this walkway. It has a glass bottom so that you can look down and see just how high you are off of the ground. And I have some pictures of it. Can I get the first picture of this? Hello. Yeah. How about the second one? Ooh. How about the third one? Okay, so that's what it would look like if you're walking across it. Okay, show of hands. How many of you would walk on that? All right, we got some thrill seekers here. All right. Some of you say that you would walk on it. And maybe that's true. But as it turns out, this is actually easier said than done. A lot of people who say they will walk on it, when it actually gets time to step out, like it's such a scary thing that they have, that it's a struggle. And I actually have a video of somebody trying to walk across this walkway for the first time. All right, can we get the video? Okay, that's not real. All right, this is a terrible, terrible special effect that they have put into the bridge with cracking noises, and it's like not really glass, it's a screen. And when you step on it, it looks like it's breaking, and just to terrify you. Is that the worst thing ever? Oh my goodness. So, I have heard that the guy in the video was in on it and he kind of knew what was going to happen. So if you any of you feel really bad for that poor guy, I don't know what made them think that was a good idea, but it is what it is. Now, the only reason I showed you this is just to point out that there's this relationship between faith and action. Faith isn't so much believing with 100% certainty that glass is going to hold you. It's more taking the step out and acting on what you believe is true, even if you have some doubts. And we see this in Abraham obeying God and going where he was called. And we also see it in another story from Abraham's life, and that's where Hebrews is going to go a little bit later here, verse 17. If you can skip down to verse 17, there's another story from Abraham's life. It says, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, 'Through Isaac shall your offspring be named.' And he considered that God was even able to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back." All right, we'll stop there. So Abraham, if you're not familiar with him, he's kind of famous for two big acts of faith. The first one being when God called him to go to a place and he didn't tell him where he went. And then the second one is this, what these verses talk about, we call it the binding of Isaac. Now in Genesis 12, when God called Abraham out of Haran to go to Canaan, he also made him this promise that he would be the father of a great nation. And at the time, Abraham, he didn't have any children. He was 75. His wife was 65. And so this was kind of a significant promise that God made to him. But then later, when Abraham's 100 and his wife is 90, through miraculous events, they have a kid named Isaac. And Isaac represents all of these promises that God made to Abraham. And every time they looked at Isaac, they would be reminded that God was faithful and that one day Abraham would be the father of a great nation. But then later in the story, there's a plot twist. And God's like, "I want you to take your son, Isaac, the son of the promise, and I want you to offer him up." Wait, what? Like, how is God going to fulfill his promises if Isaac is going to die? Like, that command just doesn't even make sense. But Abraham obeys, and he binds Isaac, and then God steps in, if you know the story, and he's like, "Okay, don't offer up Isaac. Offer up a ram instead," and he provides this ram for him. Now, this text raises a million questions. Would God really ask somebody to do that? And was Abraham really about to do this? And those are good questions for a sermon on another day, all right? But we'll just leave it for this at this point. Let's just say that we know a lot more about God than Abraham did. Right? Remember, Abraham, he is from like a pagan background. He's just used to idolatry. And the gods of the idols, like they did ask people to do stuff like that all of the time. We have thousands of years of Judeo-Christian history. We got the Bible. We got the teachings of Jesus. Like we know, okay, God would not ask us to do something like that. Abraham didn't have any of that stuff. In fact, Hebrews says that Abraham, he didn't even understand what God was going to do with all of this. He was thinking in his mind, well, maybe this God has the power to raise the dead, and so after Isaac dies, God is going to resurrect him from the dead. And, you know, we know like that was not what God's plan was for all this, but that's what Abraham had going on in his mind. And so Abraham's faith was not about having all the right answers. It was about stepping out and acting on what he believed to be true. And likewise for us, faith isn't about having all the answers. It's about acting on the things we believe to be true. Now, life is hard. And there are going to be times when we have doubts. And that's okay. Faith is not about not having doubts. It's about staying the course. It's about stepping out and acting, even when you do have doubts. Now, my son Zach, he likes to ask me difficult theological questions. I think Brooke sends him my way when he asks like the really, really hard questions. And usually they're ones that I can't answer, so I usually respond by asking him harder ones, because that way I can kind of dodge the question. But he the other day he came up to me and he asked, he's like, Dad, how do we know for sure that all of this is real and we're not just like in a video game or something like that? And so I said to him, I was like, Zach, how do you know that I'm real or that other people have minds and it's not that you're the only one with a mind and everybody else is just a figment of your imagination? How do you know that's not true? And he was quiet for a little bit and then he goes, Dad, are you real? So, But the answer to his first question is we can't be sure that that's not the case, right? We can't be sure 100% that this all isn't a dream. But likewise, we can't be sure that it is a dream, and we just have to make up our mind and we have to act without 100% certainty. And that's okay. We do that every day. Faith isn't about having 100% certainty. It's about acting on what God has said. It's about stepping out and trusting and acting, even if you have doubts, even if you don't know for sure that that glass won't crack. That's what Abraham did. By faith, he obeyed. Now, how was Abraham able to do that? Well, Hebrews is going to tell us in the text that we skipped over. So let's look at verse 13. I'm going to read verses 13 through 16. It says, now here it's talking about not just Abraham, but also Sarah and Isaac and Jacob. It says, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. If they'd been speaking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. And therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Okay, now let's stop there. How was Abraham able to do these hard things? Well, it says in verse 13 that he acknowledged that he was a stranger and an exile. He realized that this wasn't his home. He was a misfit, right? That's where we get our Champs and Misfits title is from this verse. And then in verse 16, it says that he desired a better country. I love that language. He desired a better country. Now, there's this ancient Jewish apocalypse called the Apocalypse of Abraham that seeks to fill in some of the gaps that are missing in the biblical text. So if you've never heard of this, which probably is the case, the Apocalypse of Abraham is not part of the Bible. Okay, it is it's a legend. Jeremiah called it biblical fan fiction, which I think is probably a good description of what the Apocalypse of Abraham is. But there's a lot of books like this out there that there are stories that try to fill in, like when you read through the Bible and you're like, what, why did that happen? Somebody may have written a book out there explaining why it happened. And so one of the questions that the Apocalypse of Abraham answers is, why was Abraham so quick to uproot and follow after this God that he knew nothing about? Why would someone do that when he didn't have 100% certainty? Now, like I said, the Apocalypse of Abraham is not part of the Bible, but it does try to answer this question. And in the story, Abraham's dad, Terah, which is in the Bible, that is his dad. Terah is his job is he makes idols for a living. And he principally makes idols of two gods. One's name is Barisat and one's name is Marumat. And so there's this one story. Abraham is like, he's like a young adult. He's still living at home, but he's, you know, still responsible for doing the things his dad tells him to do. And his dad makes these idols and he tells Abraham to go to the market and sell them. And so Abraham does it and he takes these idols to the market and he sells them and then he brings his dad back the money. And when he gives it to him, his dad like starts celebrating. He's like, oh, he praises the gods of these idols that he made. And Abraham is like really confused by all of it. And it's kind of an absurd picture to him. And so he says to his dad, like, I don't understand why you're thanking these gods. I mean, you made those idols. It's like, doesn't that kind of make you the god of the gods? Like, shouldn't they be thinking you? And on the one hand, he's right. And it's just like he's calling a spade a spade. But on the other hand, he's also kind of this young guy sassing his dad. And so his dad just is really mad. And he's like, hey, don't mock the gods. Instead, go make me dinner. And so the next scene is Abraham has to make dinner for his dad. And he puts the food in this pot and he's like cooking it on this wood. And he realizes he doesn't have enough wood for the fire to cook all the food. And he has to go look for firewood. But he's worried that when he leaves, that the fire's gonna go out. So he takes one of these idols that his dad has made. It's an idol of the god Barisat. And he sets it up next to the fire. And he's like, okay, Barisat, I want you to look over the fire. Make sure it doesn't go out while I'm out looking for firewood so I can come back and I can finish cooking this food for my dad. So Abraham goes off looking for firewood. And when he comes back, this god, this idol thing has fallen into the fire. And it is fueling the fire and it's cooking the food. And Abraham like laughs at the irony of all of that. And he's like, well, thank you, Barisat, for not letting my fire go out. And he cooks the food and he gives it to his dad. And when his dad gets it, he offers up this little prayer of thanksgiving to the other god that he makes idols for, Marumat. And Abraham says to him, no, you shouldn't be thanking Marumat. You should be thanking Barisat. He's the one that cooked the food, okay? And it is supposed to be a funny story. Like it points out the absurdity of idolatry, okay? That's kind of the point of the story. And like I said, it's a legend. It's biblical fan fiction. But I like the way that it portrays Abraham because it's very consistent with what we read in the actual biblical text. And that is that Abraham was dissatisfied with the idolatry of his day, okay? Abraham may not have known who the true God was, but he knew all these other things that wasn't true. He knew there had to be something else out there. He may have not known what it was, but he knew that there had to be something better out there. And that's why Hebrews says, Hebrews 11:16 says of Abraham, he longed for the better country, right? He longed for the better country. He knew there had to be something better out there. And that's where we get to the crux of this message when it comes to like perseverance through hardship. You know, there aren't always easy answers to hardships. Terrible things happen in life, and we don't know why. Right? I don't know why the good die young. I don't know why God allows us, to continue to struggle and continue to fail, even if you pray every day for deliverance. I don't know why God allows the dreams of good people to get wrecked by the sins of others. I don't know why those terrible things happen. But I do know this. There are two ways that we can respond to tragedies in life. The first is to say, there's no way that a good God would allow these things to happen and to walk away. But if we do that, then we are conceding that this world is all there is, and that these bad things that happen to us are not tragedies, they're just par for the course. That's kind of all we can expect in life. To walk away is to give up hope for anything else. To walk away is to give up hope. But the second response is to say, this can't be all there is. This can't be all there is. This is the response of Abraham to long for a better country. All right? And what does that better country look like? Well, Romans 8, 29 through 30 says, "For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified." So in other words, God is at work in our hearts. And if you struggle and you fail and you like just wonder, like, why did God make me like this? Know that you have hope. And that in the better country, you will be made perfect. Sin will no longer have dominion over you. It's the better country. Isaiah 2:4 says, "God shall judge between the nations and shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." In other words, in the better country, there'll be no more war and no more violence. It says people in that day, they're gonna melt down their swords and melt down their spears, and they're gonna take the stuff that they get from melting these, and they're gonna fashion it into farming equipment, because it's gonna be a time of peace. And we're not gonna have to be afraid anymore. It's a better country. 1 Corinthians 15, 25 through 26, it says, "For Jesus must reign until he's put all of his enemies under his feet, and the last enemy to be defeated is death." Sin and death have been defeated on the cross, and one day they will be no more. Our bodies won't break down. We won't have to say goodbye to our loved ones. We'll have life. Okay, it's the better country. And finally, Revelation 21, 3 through 4 says, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." The dwelling place of God will be with people. And he will make everything right. All of the wrongs that you've suffered, the injustices, the people who have taken advantage of you, hurt you, all of that will be made right. It's the better country. Can you dare to long for the better country? Now, I want to close with a video. We're going to watch a video testimony of Larry Olson, and then after the video, I'm going to come back up here and transition us into our time of response. And during the response time, the band's going to come back up. We're going to sing two more songs, and we're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. Now, if this is your first time here, know that you are free to come forward for the Lord's Supper, but you don't have to. You can stay where you are if that's more comfortable to you. But while we sing and while we celebrate the Lord's Supper, I'd also love to pray for you, and I will be standing right back there. Gary and Beth would also love to pray for you. They will be standing back there in that corner. So anything going on in your life, big or small, we would love to pray for you. But before we transition to the response time, I do want us to watch Larry's video. Now, a few months ago, Larry shared his story at Manor Care. We have a team that goes out and does church at a nursing home called Manor Care. And the week that he shared his story, like right after that, I had like five or six people come up to me and say, "Oh my goodness, Larry shared his story today. It was amazing. You need to get him to like share his story in front of the whole church." It was 35 minutes long. We got it into 4 minutes of a video. I asked him if he would share it, and he did. And it's awesome. And by the way, he did it as part of the Champs and Misfits series. So Jeremiah Hinton has made a whole week of devotions based on thoughts that Larry has had about life. And so if you haven't grabbed that yet, make sure you grab it at the welcome desk. We've got a couple more weeks of doing that. But one of the reasons why I wanted Larry to share his story is because God delivered him from something that had dominion over him for 30 years. his life is a glimpse of the better country. And so I want us to watch. Let's watch this video, and then I'll be back up to close this.
I'm going to tell you a story about two people. One is from the Bible. His name is Demas, a companion of Paul, and the other is me. Demas is mentioned not only as a companion of Paul, but as a co-worker that was involved in the first century ministry. I was saved when I was in the third grade at a Good News Club. I would invite my friends to church to learn about Jesus. When I was in the 11th grade, I invited my oldest brother to hear an evangelist speak at a church. After the service was over during the response time, my brother went forward and was saved. He was killed 2 days later. So I was being a worker for Christ, just as Demas was. However, every one of us come to a fork in the road of life during our lifetime. Many times we take the wrong turn. In 2 Timothy, Paul writes, "Demas, having loved the present world, has deserted me." At 17, I started smoking marijuana. Satan just wants to slowly get his foot in the door of our life, changing our lives little by little. After high school, I experimented with much harder drugs. When I was 28, I fell about 30 feet from the leg of a water tank I was working on. When I got out of the hospital and was confined to bed rest, it was an opportunity that God was giving me to give up drugs. But within weeks, I was doing drugs again. I would always lie about my drug use to my wife and others. Years later, my wife got a call from the state patrol telling her that I had been in a one vehicle accident. When she got to the hospital, the doctors were examining me, and a state patrol officer came up to her and told her they had found drugs in my truck and there would be charges against me. I was released from the hospital a few days later. God was giving me another chance to walk away from drugs. A couple of weeks later, I was at a baseball game coaching my two boys. I had done drugs before the game. During the game, I had a grand mal seizure. I was in a coma for a week. That was the turning point of my life. After almost 30 years of drug addiction, I asked Jesus to forgive me, give me a second chance, and be the Lord of my life. The Bible is full of people that have received second chances, third and even fourth chances. Peter, Paul, David, and others. You might think that Jesus can't help you with some problems in your life. That is just a lie that Satan wants you to believe. Jesus just yearns for you to ask him into your heart and to forgive your sins and let him help you with those problems and troubles. We live in a lost world and we will always have problems and troubles. And Jesus wants to help you deal with them. Demas and I were a lot alike. We both started out strong for Christ, both walked away from God. I don't know if Demas ever came back to Christ, but I did. And he has changed my life so much. Since coming back to God, he has used me in our church's Manor Care ministry to lead others to Christ. I've been forgiven, I've been changed, I have been set free. Have you been set free?
Now, I started this message by talking about the parable of the prodigal son. And I made that comment that when you long for the faraway country, it's not hard to move to the faraway country. And sure enough, in the story, that's exactly what the younger son does. He squanders his inheritance, and the next thing you know, he's starving in a pigsty. Well, if you know the story, you know that the younger son, he comes to his senses, and he decides to go back to his father and see if his father will receive him as a servant. But there's an important part of the story that just now I just breezed over. Before he goes home, what does he do? He longs for the better country. He's sitting there in this pigsty, and his imagination goes back home, and he says, even the servants in my dad's house live better than this. And so he longs for the better country, to be a servant in his father's house. But then what happens to him? The better country was even better than he thought, because his father doesn't receive him as a servant. He receives him as a son. The scriptures tell us that Jesus Christ died for sins and rose from the dead. And because Jesus paid it all, we are citizens of a better country. So if you're going through something hard today, or if you're struggling, or life is doing its best to crush your dreams, can you give that over to God? Can you dare to long for the better country? As we take the bread and as we take the cup, we remember that this isn't our home. That one day we will dine with Jesus in the better country.